This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by A Good Laugh. A good laugh. If you need one, read something written by Anne Fine. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is an interview with Anne Fine. I am absolutely delighted to share this interview with all of you. Each month this year, I'm featuring a children's writer from where I live right here in Leicestershire. And a few months ago, I was lucky enough to spend some time speaking with Anne Fine, the friendly, witty, hilarious author of favorites like Diary of a Killer Cat, Bill's New Frock, Madame Doubtfire, and The Chicken Gave It to Me. I have to apologize in advance, because you're all going to have to put up with the sound of my laughter quite a lot. Anne is such a spectacular storyteller, and she's just so darn funny that I often forgot we were recording. My only regret is that this is a podcast, so none of you can see her speaking. Quite a lot of the time when I was laughing, it wasn't just because of her wit, but because of the wickedly playful look in her eye that just sparkled out every time she smiled. Honestly, I could talk to Anne forever and never get bored. If you and your kids are unfamiliar with her work, please take this chance to get to know her. She has something to offer everyone. She's written for all ages. Some of her works are pure comedy, and others are earnest, sometimes painful explorations of human experiences and emotions. Please enjoy my conversation with Anne Fine, this month's Leicestershire children's writer. Anne Fine, I feel very lucky to sit down with you today. Can we begin by hearing you tell us about your connection to Leicestershire?
I was born there. My parents both lived there. My father lived at the posh end. He lived on South Knighton Road. And my mother lived at the poorer end. She was on the Narborough Road, on Wilberforce Road. And they got married sometime during the war. My elder sister was born there, and I was born there. And my father, his national registration number, or whatever it's called, ended in 9. So he was a Bevan boy. And so he went down the mines in Colville. And then after the war, I was born, and in 1947. And then he really, really, really wanted a boy in the days when you were allowed to say that you wanted a boy. And they had triplet girls. So at that point, my dad had, you know, obviously after the end of the war, he stopped being a miner and he started working for post office engineering. And he was quite good at radar. So he went down to Portsmouth. So we moved down to Fareham. So the only place I remember being brought up is down in Hampshire in Fareham. But we went back very, very often. When I was about 9, we moved back up as far as Northampton, which is where I went to secondary school. And every single Saturday, we drove to Leicester and we drove to one granny and then we drove over to the other granny or we went to the other granny and then we went. And it was actually, I think, quite interesting for novelists because one of them was very, very poor, a widow, no money at all in a tiny little council house. And the other, you know, they had central heating and wall-to-wall carpeting and things that, you know, were quite rare then. So that's my connection with Leicester. And so I knew it very well until I went off to university when I stopped going and visiting them because that was the 10 years in which all the grannies and grandpas died.
Your most recent book, Aftershocks, features a young protagonist who's lost his brother. I was really struck by how realistic and relatable the feelings are in this story. What experiences allowed you to so accurately portray how people deal with the death of a close family member?
I think it's horrible to have a novelist in the family. So you try your hardest not to pin people down as the basis for this or the reason for that. So I'll say only that there is somebody in my family of whom I am tremendously fond, and they lost a child. And it was not at all like this. It wasn't a horrible instant accident. It was nobody at fault. It was medical. It ground on for 2 years. It
oh,
was
my.
Ghastly. And I was at the end of the phone. I'm going to cry telling you this.
Yeah.
And so I heard all the grief and all the anguish. And I think that's what set me off on the topic. And then I think I have no experience of that. I know nobody whose child has died, you know, through the idiot behavior, which I think would be unbearable, almost unbearable. And what I would say about that is that it's imagination. I mean, you just think, if it were my child, and I've got children, I've got two daughters, if it were one of my children killed, how would I feel? And all those dark thoughts he has in the night about having revenge, and it would be, I mean, that it doesn't actually take much imagination to know that you would feel that angry. I mean, even me as a 50-year-old woman might have felt that angry if it was one of my children, probably would still now. So you can imagine that a tempestuous teenage boy with all the emotions spinning would be feeling even more strongly, as if they would want to do something about it. As regards the other thing, the way that one parent wants to talk, say the name, wants to have the person still there in the sense of in the family talked about, and the other one can't bear to think about it, can't even bear to name whose shoes they are coming out the cupboard. I think that's something that we all know from reading the papers, reading novels, reading, you know, you look around you and you know that people will feel differently and they will respond differently. And so that's just the observation and the intuition. You're thinking, well, what would I feel in my circumstances? I mean, because it takes a long time to write a book. I mean, it takes about a year to write, or more than a year to write Aftershocks. And so during that time, there is something about writing a novel that where you get antennae for the topic. From the moment you decide, for example, to write an article about stepchildren or stepmothers or something, everything you see, everything you read, everything that's on telly seems to be about it. Or you search it out, you think, oh, there's a documentary on stepfamilies. I'm going to watch that. And there'll be just something in it that you can use. And so as you go through a book, it gets enriched. And I don't call it research because it isn't research. It's just basically having your antennae up to the topic that you're writing about.
Your book, Bill's New Frock, tells the story of a boy who wakes up one day and has somehow become a girl. He has to go to school wearing a pink frock and has a very rude awakening about the way girls experience sexism. It's kind of like an episode of The Twilight Zone, really. And Bill's entire day is filled with jarring experiences like choosing not to play football because his dress is too impractical, or being told constantly that he's expected to be pretty and clean. People think he's too incompetent to cross the street or move a table, but he's plenty competent enough to do tiresome chores for other people. All of the things that happen to Bill are so realistic and familiar, especially the part where adults reinforce sexist stereotypes. He has to walk a mile in a girl's shoes, as it were. You can get a lot of grief for writing about these topics, so why did you write Bill's New Frock?
If I'm honest, there are two books that I thought would be out of print by now because the social problem would be over. One is Bill's New Frock, and one is The Chicken Gave It to Me, because I really did feel that it wouldn't take 30 years for people not to realise that chickens do not want to live in cages. And it really didn't occur to me that feminism could go so badly off the rails, so badly off the rails that, you know, women can wear those 4-inch high heels and thongs and God knows what, and still think they're feminists. I mean, how you can call it empowerment is absolutely beyond me. I'm a real old-fashioned feminist that way.
Yes.
It drives me crazy. And I do have to say that Bill's New Frock was never published in the States, along with all the other books were being published in the States, almost all of them, but not that one, because it didn't mean anything to Americans, because they had gone to such trouble, such trouble, to eradicate sexism in the school. And American teachers, that we were living in America at the time, we lived in California and we lived in Michigan. And it seemed to me that feminism was doing a whole lot better in the States. So there we were in the States. Sexism had been eradicated in most of the textbooks. So you would have girls counting car tires and you would have boys counting cotton reels in the illustrations, that sort of thing. And then we came home to Scotland and we put her in the local primary school. Honestly, Tiffany, I cannot tell you how annoying it was. The boys would all be led off to do woodwork and the girls would all be led off to do sewing. And they were astonished, you know, they were just astonished. And I said, well, maybe next week the girls will do woodwork and the boys have no such luck. After a few weeks, I went down to the school and I said, look, you're supposed to be a non-sexist, non-racist school. And you can forget about non-racism, because at that time, being English in Scotland was most unpleasant. Mrs. Thatcher was driving the poll tax through. And if you even opened your mouth with an English accent, you're in trouble. It was just horrible. I mean, they really don't like the English, the Scots. They just don't. So as far as I can make out. Anyway, so she said, nobody else has complained, Mrs. Fine. And so I went and complained to the head of Lothian Region Education Department, who earned $40,000 a year back then to do his job. And guess what he said? He said, there's nothing you can do about these old teachers, Mrs. Fine. You just have to wait for them to retire. I mean, what a council of despair was that? And of course, the pen is supposed to be mightier than the sword. And when I was young and in primary school and all the boys were doing woodwork and all the girls were doing sewing, because that was back in 1950s, right? We had to sew a tray cloth. Now, I think feminism must have moved on, because I very much doubt whether any children now know what a tray cloth even is. And you probably don't even
know
what a tray cloth is. But we had to, yeah, it was a piece of material you put on a tray, God knows why, and it soaked up all the tea drips and the jam and the stains that fell off the tea tray. And so then you had to wash it and get the stains out of it, and you had to iron it, and they were decorated. I mean, they were completely useless. They were a waste of women's time par excellence. And nobody has them now. Nobody's even heard of them, and nobody misses them. And they were completely pointless, except that they chewed up women's lives. But we had to sew one. I remember sewing it to my skirt, because we had to learn to embroider and all that. And you had to choose a motto. And I chose, the pen is mightier than the sword. I had no idea what that meant. I was about, nine? I probably thought pens were very sharp then. They were those little tin things with, you know, I probably thought you could stab someone to death with a pen. That's what, with a pen, that's what I probably thought. Anyway, so that's why I wrote Bill's New Frock. I'm astonished it's still in print, because it's just basic feminism, which you would have thought would go without saying now, but ho, ho, ho. And it's interesting how people, I mean, my point was obvious. It was, if this is unsuitable for Bill, then we should be asking ourselves, is it suitable for the girls as well?
You That's would think
the whole
so.
Point of the book.
You would think
That's
so.
That's what it's about. But now, you know, you get teachers thinking that you were ahead of the boy in the red dress, that it's about cross-dressing. And it isn't. I mean, he's mystified by what happens. He's just mystified. It's just a joke. I mean, my agent said of it when it first, she had no idea it was going to be such a seller for so long. And she said, well, the good thing about it, dear, she said, is that you're no sooner into it Then you're out of it again. And you could see that she thought this was the book's greatest virtue, that it was, you know, before you could even realise what had hit you. I don't know. There was a dramatisation. I know you've got a question on dramatisation by Andrew Davis. It wasn't the first time anything of mine had been adapted, but it was the first time any adapter had ignored what I meant and just done what they did. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Davis, I could have pushed him in a canal. I really could have, because he just made it, girls can be as nasty as boys. And that's not the point. That wasn't the point of it at all. Though I said nothing, because there's nothing you can say and you just end up in the paper sounding like a grumpy old person. So what's the point?
Feminism isn't about telling women they should be as disgusting as the bad men.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There was a lot of research went into it. I mean, to be fair, there were people working on the business of sexism in schools. The Department for Education and Science, as it was called then, had done a lot of research on sexism in the schools. And I did use, it wasn't just fury at Stockbridge Primary School, Edinburgh. It was also research.
You've been through the experience of having one of your books adapted as a major motion picture. Being from Los Angeles, I had a lot of chances to visit movie sets or talk to family, friends, and neighbors who work in the film industry. So I know how heavily a story can be modified once it enters production and how many people can be involved in that process. As an author, what did you find exciting and what did you find challenging about having your work adapted for film?
I had nothing to do with the film. And that was deliberate. Mm-hmm. We had lived in California for 5 years.
Oh, yeah,
wow. 5.5 years with my husband's job. He is a philosopher. I knew enough to know that the author gets invited and then everybody gets over and she's like, oh, I'm so thrilled to meet you, you know. And then you're a spare pudding and nobody wants you and you've got no control whatsoever. The only mm-hmm. person I have ever come across who has any control in the film at all is J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
And that's because she had final script
she
control.
She wrote it in the contract.
Yeah, exactly. But in the contracts now, it says you're not even allowed to criticise the film. Now, I did not have that so far as I know. I could have criticised the film, but I wasn't going to because it had been optioned for 10 years, or no, 6 or 7 years. Every time the option got renewed after 3 years, I got a slightly better deal. So they made the film, and I knew that I didn't want to go and watch it being made. If I'm scrupulously honest, and you may say this, I find actors a bit much. They're mm-hmm. so overenthusiastic mm-hmm. that they kind of paralyze me personally. And I don't kind of believe them anyway. I just think of
you shouldn't.
If they say you shouldn't. They're acting anyway.
Yep.
So exactly. I stay away. And it was a nice enough check to pay off the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And you don't bite the hand that's just paid off your mortgage, do you?
That's fair enough. So, no, not at all.
I just stayed away. When the film came out, I went to see it at the first showing in London. And I was quite shocked by it because for reasons to do with bums on seats in the first weekend, they always want to make it a 14 plus or, you know, a higher ranking. Mm-hmm. They won't have it as a PG. So they had put in things in the film that were completely inappropriate that I would never have countenanced, let alone written. One was sexual, a sexual joke, which was had
Yikes.
No place at all in that sort of a film.
No.
And the other was language, which I don't mind because I'm pretty potty mouthed myself, but you know, Americans. So the version I saw had a couple of moments in it which I thought, actually, that's really bad of them. Later, when it came out in video, because these are the days of old video shops, right? They'd taken those bits out.
Mm.
But anyway, it did pay off the mortgage. And so, if I'm honest, I didn't find it challenging at all. Oh, I was asked one thing. Chris Columbus was the producer or director, whichever it is, you would know, sent me a letter on some paper that was the heaviest paper I've ever seen in my life. One sheet of it, and you were practically exhausted holding it. It was so posh, this paper. And it just had his name, no address, no phone number, no fax, no nothing. Just had his name up in the top left-hand corner. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And he said, you know, we hope we do your book justice and blah, blah. It's a nice note. And if there's anything, just let us know. And I wrote back and I thought, I'll be like the fairy tale, you know, where the youngest daughter says, oh, just bring me back a single rose, Daddy. And all the elder sisters are wanting diamonds, rubies. They just bring me a single rose.
Oh.
And I thought, so I'm going to ask her something very simple. And he had just made Home Alone and Home Alone 2. And I can't stand bratty children. I don't like bratty children. Nobody likes bratty children.
No.
And I didn't want my children bratty. So I just said, please don't make the children bratty.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether he would have or wouldn't have, or whether he listened or whether he didn't. I don't know, and I don't care. All I know is that they were perfectly reasonable, identifiable with children, like mm-hmm. most children are.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that that is one of the reasons why the film was such a success, because I think children could actually identify with these three children. I mean, they had their moods, they lost it occasionally, but they were essentially trying quite hard.
When I watched Mrs. Doubtfire as a child, I identified with the children for sure.
Well, there you go. There you go. I think if I've got an objection, which I don't really, but because you just get philosophical about this sort of thing, it's that author of Madame Doubtfire hangs around your neck for the rest of your career. And I am glad that I had written more books before, and, you know, that it was other books that won the Carnegie Medal, not those two, because it was easier to remind myself that that was not entirely how I was viewed, particularly mm-hmm. in the book world, because if people knew books, they knew Flower Babies and they knew mm-hmm. Goggle Eyes and they knew Bill's New Frock, and later they knew Killer Cats. So it wasn't always author of Mrs. Doubtfire, though it was for years.
I love cats and I've owned several over the years, so I can honestly say that cats are jerks. And I've never read anything that more hilariously embraces that than your series of books that begins with Diary of a Killer Cat. You had to have been inspired by some frustrating yet adorable furballs in order to write these books so well. So can you tell me about cats that you've known and loved, or known and tried to love?
Oh, Tiffany, I hate cats. I hate all cats. I've always hated cats. Ghastly, creepy, selfish.
Well, they're awful. Yucky, cats are awful.
Damaging, nasty, nasty things. And the only reason we had a cat is my stupidity. So there we were in America. And I said to Cordelia, we're going home. We're going back to Britain. And she said, well, I'm not going. She was 7. And she said, well, I'm not going. And I said, well, of course you're going. I mean, it's the family. We're going home. And she said, I'm not going because I want to stay here. And I said, well, you can't. And she said, well, I'm going to stay here and live with Sarah and carry on going to this school. And I said, no, you've got to come back. You've got to come back. And she said, no. And like a fool, I mean, it's like another fairy tale. These fairy tales, they really do hit the spot. Because when she says, you can have my firstborn child if you just spin all this straw into gold for me overnight. Yeah, and then she shows up and wants the firstborn child. He doesn't, he Rumpelstiltskin. And it was like that. I said, well, of course, if you go back to Britain, you can have a cat. I always wanted a cat, haven't you? So anyway, we went back to Britain, and like almost the next day, I don't think I'd even unpacked. You can have my cat now. we had to get her a cat. And it was a horrible cat. I mean, it liked her. She would wear it hanging around her neck. You know, it would put up with anything from her. It hated us. I hated it. Dick, the man I live with, who is a gardener and a botanist and likes birdies and everything, he hated it more than I did because it dug up all his vegetables. Yeah. It pooed in his spring onions. We hated it. And she was at home, obviously, for the first many, many years. Then she went off to university and left it with us. And there was nothing we could do because whenever she rang up, "How's the cat? How's the cat?" And then she got married to a New Zealander and they went to live in Melbourne. And she couldn't take the cat to Melbourne. No. So she left us with a bloody cat for another. And this cat was, I began to think it was immortal. It just carried on decades. And it scratched all the furniture. It ruined all the furniture. When it didn't want to go outside to poo, it would go upstairs and pee on the carpet. And then it got ill. Thank God. And we took it up with the vet. And we had to both go. We don't always do everything together. We had to go because we had to be able to just make it clear to her when she rang that nobody had done her cat wrong. So we went up with this scraggy kidney disease, manky, bad-tempered thing. And the vet said, I've never been happier. The vet said, "This cat is on a high road to nowhere," he said. "Would you like to take it home and love it a little bit longer?" And we said, no, put it out of its misery now. So he put it out of its misery. You know, the cat died. We went home and we got so drunk on champagne that I haven't drunk champagne since. Oh, that's the cat.
Has your approach to storytelling changed at all over the course of your career?
I think I'm a bit more simple than I was. If you read things like Round Behind the Ice House, which is one of my most personal books in a funny sort of way, I mean, I think Round Behind the Ice House reeks of homesickness, and I wrote it when I was in America and I wanted to come home. And it's all about weather and land. And I think when I was in America, I thought a lot. I did a sort of unofficial psychology degree. I mean, I read a huge amount of psychology. There was something about being in America where everybody reinvents themselves,
yes,
and feels that there are fresh starts, which it was not the case here. It is more now here, but then it wasn't it? It was Americans. I can do this. I can be this.
Yes.
I don't have to be hampered by my background. And so I just started reading all psychology. And I think after that, I stopped being inward looking with the books. And I came back to Britain after 7 years and started being more interested in the world around me. That's why the books started being about other families, other things. And so I became interested in, you know, mixed families and family problems. And they were not my problems, particularly at the time, because I had a pretty stable family life. I was just interested in the outer world. So I went from being quite a bit centred on me as a writer, even though it was all disguised and everything. And then I became interested in the outer world. And I think over the last few years, well, the main change was writing for younger children, but that was because Kit and I split up and he stayed in America. And I felt a bit uneasy just in case I needed to be financially a bit more secure. And I said to my agent, who is dead now, his name is Murray Pollinger, and I said, "I'm not making any money at all." And he said, "No, you won't make money writing for older children, will you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you know, if you're the parent of an older child and they want a book, you send them to the library. If you want to make money, you write for younger children." And I thought, well, you could have mentioned that before. So I wrote Bill's New Frock for younger children, whereas left to myself, I'd probably have written it as a teenage book.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the issues much more, you know, subtly woven in instead of just a simple comedy. And that worked. And so, but I like writing for all age groups. And I just think that as I've got older, my writing has got a bit simpler. Other people notice things about your book more than you do yourself. I mean, that's absolutely true. I remember Peter, whatever his name is, he's an academic at York. And I remember he wrote an article about my work. And he said, when Anne Vine is writing for younger children, home is the safe place and school is the slightly dangerous one. And when she's writing for older children, school is the safe place and home is the dangerous one. Actually, up to a huge amount of truth, he's right. I mean, you take something like Only a Show, which is for, you know, 8-year-olds, 7-year-olds, and she's terrified of the idea of having to give a performance, but everybody at home is, you know, bolstering her up. Basically, other people know your work in some ways a lot better than you do. I think I know the quality of my work. I think I know which books are good, but I think other people know what I'm doing quite often better than I do.
Sometimes it's easier to have perspective from the outside.
Ah, yes. Yes. I think that's true. Somebody can have more perspective from the outside. It's also interesting what other people see in your work. Because, for example, in all the body of work, as far as I remember, there is only one social worker, and that is in The Tulip Touch. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty glancing, right? Never taken into care or anything. So I am seen as dealing with all these incredibly troubled families. But at one level, they're not troubled at all. They're just families where people have a row. I mean, Book of the Banshee, no social workers in that. I mean, there's some tremendous rows in the Book of the Banshee, and there's a tremendous row at the end of Madame Doubtfire, isn't there, when the children lose it. They're just within quite stable families. And I do think that was true of my own family, that my mum had a temper. Oh, my golly, did she have a temper. But it was a very stable family.
What are you working on right now?
Well, like most authors, I'm quite secretive about what I'm working on. but I've nearly finished it. It's set in first year secondary, but it's really a book for probably top primary. It's just about one academic year and the effect that one child has on everybody in his year. It's incredibly light. I mean, it's one of the lightest, merriest, easiest books. I've really enjoyed writing it. I mean, I think, you know, the last one, Aftershocks, was pretty harrowing to write at places. When you go back and read a book, with the distance that time brings, you can be quite startled by how tough you've been. Because when you're writing, I'm not saying you're exactly like Walt Disney with a, you know, cigar hanging out of your mouth and, that'll make them cry. You know, I'm not saying it's exactly like that, but it is. And when you read the book later, you think, wow, that is strong stuff.
I think these days we can all use something light.
Yeah, oh, well, that's nice. Well, I think we could use this. I mean, this business of distance, you take Flower Babies. Do you know the book Flower Babies?
I'm afraid not.
No, well, if you read Flower Babies, it's again one of these books where it's set off by a simple little idea, which was an American school, for real, in California, had a high pregnancy rate for underage pregnancies. So they gave all of their children a 6-pound flower bag, and they had to keep them for 3 weeks, you know, keep them clean, keep them dry, keep them blah, blah, keep a diary. And then they handed them back, and they were quoted as saying, I've got the article. They were quoted as saying, well, it didn't cry, and it didn't fill its nappy, and it didn't scream, and I could cheat with the babysitting. I still couldn't wait to be rid of it. You know, couldn't wait to hear you do it. And so I give, it's a boys' school. I make it a boys' school because I know that realistically, if it were a mixed school, the girls would take the flower bags and they'd look after them for the boys, blah, blah, blah. So I make it a boys' school and we go through them all having to have these dreadful flower bags. And Simon, whose dad walked out when he was 6 weeks old, begins to think about his dad and why his dad walked out and all that stuff. And I wrote the book and I thought I was just following the California schools. You would never use a flour bag. If a school were going to do it, I'd say use lentils or something. It'd be so much safer around computers. Anyhow, so the book, in those days, the books came back as galley proofs. I was reading it and he explodes his flour bag at the end. He just explodes it. He's had enough of it. He loses it. You know, and he sails out. The last page is actually enough to make you cry because all the teachers stand back and watch this vision in white flower, as it were, walking out of the school into, I think it's into his untrammeled youth or something. I mean, you'd never be allowed to get away with the word untrammeled now, would you? They're so bloody boring, but it's a rather fine last sentence. And then I realised, when I finally read it in proof form after it had been edited and this and that and niggle, 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 and then a year later, off it come. I wrote it the year that my youngest child went off to university. So she went to Oxford, where you're not allowed to come home in the middle of the term. Well, you know, you're not supposed to. And coming up to Edinburgh would take you all day, and then going back the next day would take you all day. So we didn't see her for 7 weeks. And I'd been at home for all those years writing, you know, being a parent, always there, you know, because where would I be? I mean, I, you know, they come home from school in a filthy mood and kicking the doors and fetching their plaster down because somebody had bugged them about at school or something. And all of a sudden there was nobody in the house but me and Dick. And I realised it was a much more personal book than I had ever realised. I mean, everything that I liked about babies is in the book. And everything that is exhausting about babies is in the book. You know, the business that you can make a baby laugh by just sticking a finger on its nose. I think what I liked about babies, what I've always liked about babies, is that you can love them absolutely unconditionally when they're very little. I mean, you never lean over the cot and think, you know, you're not pulling your weight in this relationship, baby. I mean, you just don't do that. You see, okay, it's give, give, give without feeling any of the feelings that you have with a spouse, mm-hmm. which is, you know, excuse me, you didn't have to leave those underpants there or those, you know, all those niggly feelings you get unless you live with a saint, which few of us do. Oh, well, I'm not a saint either, obviously. I wouldn't want to live with me.
Anne Fine, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
You can find Anne Fine online at annefine.co.uk. You can find her books at all major online retailers and in your local bookshop. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.